Broadcasting live from Roberta's in Bushwick, Brooklyn, you're listening to HeritageRadioNetwork.com. Today we'd like to send a special thank you to the following restaurants for supporting No Goat Left Behind: Fatty Q, Fatty Q Brooklyn, and Fatty Crab Downtown. Show your support at these restaurants by ordering one of the menu items featuring goat. Goat is the most eaten protein in the entire world, yet in the US we import most of our goat. Our dairy farms are forced to kill some male goats at birth because there's no market for them. Help make a change. Support No Goat Left Behind.
All right. It's Sunday, and that means Meet the Press and the Main Course. I'm Patrick Martins. It is Sunday. We're broadcasting live out of Roberta's restaurant, 261 Moore Street. We have a great show today. We're going to have Corwin Cave on, the real spine, the backbone to the Fatty Crab Empire. We're going to have Anthony Butler, who runs the largest emergency food service in Brooklyn. About, I think, 7,000 meals a day. We have a special co-founder of Heritage Foods is sitting in the studio. He's raising it up with his hands, and his name is Todd Wickstrom. Todd?
Yes, good to be here.
He's works at Rishi Tea now, and might hear some interesting facts about tea throughout the show. But, as people know, or maybe people know, I now do this show alone. So my goal, Katie Kiefer does her own more political show right after. So now I have my own show. I'm alone. I want to be number one. I want to be the highest rated show on the network. To date, I think my mother has been my primary listener. But I'm hoping to double that today and eventually own the network in terms of ratings. So
good luck.
Slowly but surely. So I don't really, bear with me as I do these intros. They've never been very good, but I'm going to try to, make them good.
They're much better.
They're much better. Thanks, Jack. Is that Jack or is that a machine?
No, it's Jack.
Okay, it's better. It's better.
The machine has the day off.
So I just want to say, three or four things I'll just mention. I didn't really, I thought I would try to improv this thing, just so because when I write it, it's not always the best intro. So here we go. Food Channel, I've always been amazed. This is really going to jump from one topic to another. Food Channel, 24/7 of content for what, 10, 12 years? Is that right? 10, 12 years. They have not, to my knowledge, ever had 30 minutes of serious content. I'm not saying 30 minutes a day or a week. I'm saying in the history
combined
of 24/7 for 10 years, I don't think there has been literally close to one serious topic covered on that. Corn prices going up, biodiversity issues, worker rights, slaughterhouse abuse, pollution of the rivers from companies like Smithfield and Purdue. I mean, name the topic. I literally do not think, not on a Sunday morning, not at midnight, they have never had a serious show. I find that kind of outrageous.
But it's not so much about food.
What, really? It's about recipes?
It's about entertainment.
If you're right, I have a food entertainment show in 10 years, you got to have one show. Just one, I think. Even if you cancel it a week later and you're like, oh, it had no ratings. But, okay, you're right. It is entertainment. Still, though, I think it's a responsibility. I'm proud to say Heritage Foods USA, which is a company that we started, donated a 23-pound bone-in ham to Occupy Wall Street.
Yeah, buddy.
It's being cooked for those guys. I really love it. Government did its best. Obama tried to really get these guys who basically are bordering on being, doing illegal things and stealing from people who don't know better. I love that the public is doing that. And Bloomberg now is like power washing the streets and doing all this silly stuff. But, the people are speaking and it's around the world. They're going to have to reckon with it. So I think that's pretty cool.
Hey, Patrick, greenhorns are down there. Carlos went over the weekend, said he saw a whole greenhorn stand.
Does that mean he could be arrested and you're going to have to man the station alone all week?
It's possible.
Maybe he was power washed. He could use it. and Saxelby and I, my fiance, we talked at Yale and to about 40 students, including, I found out, Danny Meyer's daughter, who's nice. A freshman there. And we talked about, among other things, the importance of apprenticing and learning a craft, even though those are like the highest, smartest kids of their in the world, how important it is to learn how to debone a ham or how to make tea very well. You know, just doing something. That was like the most important thing that I kind of got out of it. And I found out the students too, like school doesn't usually teach, just go the hell out there. You want to be working beer, then make beer.
Right.
You know, and I think a lot of times people don't have this idea of really needing to work hard at something. And then all of a sudden, how special and unique that makes them, because every batch of beer will be different, or every vodka that they might make in their room, you know, is different. So finally, I'll say, Jack, did we have a book, someone who wrote a book called Cooking with Style and Grace?
That was roughly it, yeah.
Style and Grace. Isn't the cardinal rule of grace not saying that you have grace? But anyway, I found that weird. I don't know who did it, but I heard that someone had a book like Cooking with Grace. I'm like, are they allowed to say that about themselves if they have grace? Anyway, and then finally I did eat at two restaurants that serve goat this week. Union Square Cafe, they had the goat and the pappardelle. They also sold goat sliders. And then I went to Mama Fuku Noodle Bar yesterday with Todd, and that was very, very interesting. They had goat ramen, and it is just so friggin' cool to see goat appearing randomly in little quiet spaces across a menu, and knowing that that's happening across New York and even a little bit across the country for the goat. I think that's powerful. So let's take a 10-second break, and then we'll come back with Jack Engineering and Producing and Corwin Cave in studio.
By the way, goat tacos at Palo Santo were also delicious.
Oh, nice.
We are just common threads trying to be a stitch. Weaved in the pattern of this life we're trying to live. We're holding what we have together to give what we can give him.
Now I recognize them. That's Cherry Holmes. Their band has broken up, but they have been playing all our between segment music for a few years now. And she is a beautiful woman. There are actually some very beautiful people sitting at Roberta's. If you're a guy, for sure, you should come to the back farm here, because there are some beautiful, beautiful women. And if you're a girl, I mean, there's some older guys that are fairly attractive. Anyway, talking of attractive people, we have Corwin Cave here. While most chefs grew up around food, Corwin Cave has a unique culinary heritage. The chef de cuisine of at both Fatty Crab locations, uptown and downtown, Corwin fell in love with the tongue-scalding dishes of Asia while working as a contract model in Singapore and Hong Kong. So, Corwin, welcome to the studio.
Thank you, Patrick. It's good to be here.
Oh, totally awesome. I'm so happy you could come in. So, tell us, just to start things off, tell us, what did you grow up eating?
Well, I spent a lot of time when I was young, and thanks to my parents for this, we did a lot of traveling. So I got to spend a lot of time abroad and, you know, expand my culinary heritage. But, you know, unbeknownst to me, I wasn't a real big foodie when I was, you know, say 12 years old. But I remember some, you know, some really fond memories of spending some time in France and, you know, in the countryside, and, you know, just kind of snapshots in my head now mean, I think, a lot more now than they did then. But just having, I think, my real first fine dining experience, and having, you know, like 10 feet between tables, huge round tables with way too much space for yourself, waiters that would come and go without you even noticing. I'd never experienced that before, and that was a big eye opener for me. And I realized pretty much then and there how special dining can be. And it wasn't just, you know, really just, it wasn't just about the food. It's about the service. It's about being on a vineyard. You know, I think I was 12. Maybe, I don't know, maybe younger, but I was drinking, because everybody is drinking in France. But, you know, I spent time traveling, I spent time eating, and food has always been a big part of my family, especially with my mom. She has been making chocolates forever, and it used to be a giveaway for friends and family and my dad's business partners, and it grew to be this cult following where everybody wanted to be on the list the next year. You know, if they got left off the chocolate list, it was a really big deal.
That was worse than Santa Claus ignoring you.
Oh man,
it was not nice.
And we used to all make them together. It was kind of actually something that happened on our block with our neighbors. We'd all come together and make chocolates and eat chocolate.
Well, very interesting. Yeah, well, Roni Sue, of course, has a very successful business at the Essex Street Market, right across from a fish stand and the Heritage Meat Shop, and she seems to do very well there. Where did you actually grow up? In what town?
I grew up in Belmore, in Long Island.
Belmore, Long Island.
Yeah.
And is there, I'm always fascinated by this thought, is there like a, were you genetically predisposed to certain foods, like in terms of your ancestors and where they came from? Like, I think about my mother's side and I think Russian cabbage, and I actually do like those foods very much. Or Brazil, I guess, is meats and onions and things like root vegetables. So, you know, I'm a big fan. Do you think, is there some ingredients that you think that you're almost genetically drawn to and just love?
You know, it's actually kind of a running joke with especially Jory, that I am I'm a total mutt, and I'm basically half everything.
Jory, of course, is Zach Palacios, who's your partner, and that's his wife or
fiance.
Fiance, wife, okay.
Yeah. Soon to be.
Yeah, don't jump the gun.
Sorry, Zach. You're still free, Zach.
It's funny, you know, because I am part Russian. I have Polish and French, and I got a lot going on. But I would say I couldn't pinpoint one exact ingredient that I'm super mm-hmm. passionate about because of where I may or may not come from. Mm-hmm. But you know, I do think that, you know, your environment does obviously you know, mold who you are as a person, and of course it does, you know, on your palate as well. And I'm definitely not going to say that Long Island was that place, because mm-hmm. It's not. Yeah. Anybody who's been to Long Island knows exactly what that means. But I was fortunate enough to be able to graduate high school and leave Long Island immediately, and I went to straight to culinary school in Vermont and surrounded myself with a lot of people. Yeah, I went to NECI. Yeah,
okay.
Surrounded myself with a lot of people that during that time, I mean, this was 1999, before the millennium, so you know, things were different then.
The old days.
Yeah,
I was in Italy, you were in Vermont. You know, we were just getting our feet wet. What do they call that? Water behind the ears or wet behind the ears? We were drying our ears, I guess. That's really cool. So you graduated from there? You spent...
Yeah, I graduated from NECI. And it's, you know, there's during that time, I was by far the youngest person that was there. Mm-hmm. I think I was 17 when I got to culinary school. And
really?
Everybody that was in my, you know, dorm, which were all these like little houses, or, you know, strewn about Essex, they were all like 30 and up, and had already been in the industry for a long time. So I got to work with a lot of people who were already cooks, you know, and already had their chops broken and were just attending culinary school because they felt getting a proper education would help them in, you know, their job hunt later on.
And do you believe that, or do you feel like what I was talking about in the intro, apprenticing? I mean, can you say that one's better than the other, or it depends?
Well, I mean, it's different paths. I'd say nowadays you're probably better not going to culinary school if you can get yourself a job or an apprenticeship. Culinary schools now just really accept just about anybody. When I went to NECI, they wouldn't accept me without 2 years of experience. Mm. So I started in high school studying at BOCES, a vocational studies program, and also working after school as a busboy, prep cook, dishwasher, you know, kind of all that. So when I got to school, I had experience.
Did that make it easier on your parents to see that you were working at it? I mean, were they encouraging of a chef career? Because, I mean, back then... You were early on in that move where it's okay to say, I want to be a chef and work in a kitchen all night.
Yeah, no, I mean, my parents are fairly open-minded. And like I said, you know, I mean, you know, food and travel has always been a big thing. So, you know, the best thing about being a chef is, I mean, I could walk out of this room right now, hop on a plane and get a job wherever I land, mm-hmm. As long as I have my knives. There's this freedom associated with it. And at the time, you know, it was starting to be a very glamorous position. position. Food Network was just getting going. Iron Chef was the hot rage. Mm-hmm. You know, we were, you know, after class, that's what we were watching, you know. Wow. So,
and so the school, is there a camaraderie with the people that you went to school with? Or is it sort of like once you're done, you forget about them and you move on to other things?
No, I mean, there's definitely a camaraderie. I mean, you know, Facebook has brought everybody together again. Right. I think, you know, again, the difference between culinary school then and what's been happening now is just now it's they're just going in and going out, and everybody's right. just turning them over. And the quality of student that comes out of culinary school right now is just lower. It's because, you know, they pay more for their tuition.
Right.
I mean, like, my, you know, my friends who, you know, went to university and you know, to hear what they have to pay in student loans now as compared to what, you know, I had to shell out, it's ridiculous.
Most of them are on Wall Street now, I think, picketing with signs.
Yeah.
Up front.
Or maybe leaving Wall Street to go to culinary school, right. one of the
exactly.
two.
Yeah. Was there anything that you felt was missing from your education? I mean, obviously, you probably learned good knife skills and so forth and ingredient combinations, but...
Yeah. No, I'm not a spokesperson for Necky, but the education there was actually really, really good. The thing that I loved about Necky and what was actually so unique is when I went to take a tour of the campuses, I actually went to the wrong one. I went to Montpelier and I had a interview in Essex, and I showed up and they're like, oh, you're supposed to be at the other campus, whatever. But the guy still took me on a tour, and we went out to breakfast. He was like, I'll take you out to breakfast, let's talk. And we sat down, and I had I was in this really nice cafe, and I had these blueberry pancakes that were like phenomenal, the best pancakes I've ever had, you know. And I was like, oh man, this is so good. And we were like talking, and he's like, all right, you know, I'm gonna start giving you a tour of what's going on. He's like, so what do you think of the food? And I was like, everything's so good. And he's like, well, this is one of our restaurants, and everybody back there is a first year student. And it was like, I had toured, you know, CIA, Johnson & Wales. I really did, you know, the due diligence. And everywhere at CIA, which is a very pretty place, it's just, you know, huge textbooks, huge lecture halls, no kitchens, you know, that I saw. You know, mm-hmm. I saw like four kitchens. And Necky, everything is a restaurant.
Hands-on. So,
yeah, I mean, when you're butchering, for a customer, and you're learning how to do it, but that product goes someplace. You're not wasting anything. Everything gets sold and consumed, which, of course, is great for Necky, because they have all this free labor. But at the end of the day, it also makes a lot of sense. You know, it's mm-hmm. like, you learn...
Because you got to be in the fire, so to say. You know, you have to actually be with timing, and you can't just
Yeah, when you work the line, you work the line.
Yeah.
Which is excellent. So, you know, it actually was a level of an apprenticeship and an education at the same time.
Oh, that's right.
So yeah, when I left, I felt very confident.
But it was Asia that really. I mean, was it Asia? I mean, you spent some time there. Is that really where was that the epiphany? I mean, was that where you were like, I want to be cooking this food back in the States? I mean, tell me about your relationship to your travels out there and what you learned.
Yeah, I hadn't cooked anything Asian until I got back from Asia. I was working at 11 Madison Park, actually, when I left, and I'd mainly done fairly traditional French food and, you know, contemporary American. And when I got to Asia and I spent some time, and I had a lot of free time. I mean, modeling is not hard.
It's not cold. It doesn't get cold out there on the beach.
No. Yeah. Well, I mean, Singapore is an interesting place. I lived in Singapore for like 8 months, and it's really easy to travel from, but Singapore itself is not extremely exciting. There are no beaches. The beaches are man-made.
Oh,
it's not it's not really tropical and luxurious, but...
And does it cost $300 to go to the beach or something? I always remember everything being so expensive there.
Yeah, well, at the time, you know, this is a long time ago. At the time, it wasn't bad. I mean, I made out pretty well. Everything was like half price for me. But yeah, I mean, I got to spend a lot of time traveling. I got to, you know, spend a lot of time walking around. And directly underneath where I was staying, there was a hawker area, and I spent some time with these guys who were from Hong Kong, who opened up a, you know, Hong Kong style restaurant, you know, these little hawker stalls. And I just watched them, and, you know, I ate there a couple times, and I would just hang out, and I was like, hey, can I just hang out with you guys and peel something, you know? So they let me peel shallots and peel garlic, and I just stand there and watch them cook. And these guys were, you know, just fantastic. And the food that they put out, salt and pepper frog's legs, black pepper crab, and just, you know, abalone dishes and just really cool stuff. And, you know, you're in a wet market and a hawker stall at the same time. So it's like everything is just so fresh. And it's
so it's not bad. I mean, you think street food, you think kind of lowest common denominator ingredients and stuff, but that doesn't sound like it's the case there.
Well, that's all you eat. People, you know, restaurants are for tourists when you go to Asia.
Right.
I mean, you don't actually sit inside anywhere, and it's wonderful because you walk through a market and then you sit down and you eat, and it's where people hang out, it's where they drink, it's where they meet to have coffee, teitori. Mm-hmm. It's such a community spirit, and it feels so much more natural than what happens in the States. And, mm-hmm. and that was, you know, that was, I think, the most important part of it. It was just so easy to have food be a part of your life. And I learned a lot just by eating and traveling. I spent some time in Indonesia and Thailand, Malaysia, and eventually moved to Hong Kong and traveled on, you know, in the mainland of China a little bit, Shenzhen and Guangzhou.
And you learned the language, or...?
No, I mean, you know, I picked up some, like, Singlish.
Singlish.
Yeah. You know, seriously, it's almost like another language. I mean, I was on the bus, and, you know, there was a high school near me, and these kids, they talk, they're speaking English, I think, you know, but I can't understand a word they're saying. So, yeah, I mean, it kind of is like another language. But
so China, that must have been fascinating. These towns you would go to, and you would just walk up and try to get a job, a paid job for 2 days, or
no. I mean, I had a working visa in China, but my working visa is very specific, and nobody would actually want to hire me. I just told everybody I was a student, so you know they wouldn't bother me. But really, you know, I did the only real work I was able to do was when I was in Singapore, because everybody speaks English and it's a lot easier to get your point across. But in China, it was really just about walking around and traveling, and Hong Kong is incredible. I would really just go out and get lost on purpose and just wander my way around and, you know, walk through the night markets. Mm-hmm. Shenzhen and Guangzhou were more of just an experience. It's very industrial, and, you know, it's the place where everybody goes to go shopping. And there's food is out on the streets and it's very much a, you know, a small, tight-knit community in these big cities. But, you know, mainland China is kind of strange. You know, I didn't spend more than just a day at a time at each place. But, you know, the biggest influences I had were definitely just eating in noodle shops in Hong Kong. And
can you eat at ones that good here in the States? I mean, or is it like Mexican food where people always lament that you just can't eat good Mexican here in New York, for instance?
There's incredible, you know, Singaporean style food. It's incredible Thai food. The one thing that I haven't really bumped into that really strikes as perfect is this opulent high-end Chinese food that exists in Hong Kong, and you can't really call it Chinese. It's like a lot of scallops and abalone and shark fin soup and bird's nest soup and all stuff that I'm really not into, but you know, the way that the dining rooms are decorated and how the service is done there, it's really, really over the top and decadent and extremely expensive. Huh. And that's something that, you know, nobody really does in the States. There's, you know, big banquet halls where you can have dim sum and, you know, you can have these you know, huge rooms and these large tables and what appears to be opulent, but it's a little more almost cafeteria. Mm-hmm. And these rooms are just, you know, I mean, the walls are made of gold. It's like, it's serious. It's kind of funny. It's got its own twist.
So was that your first interaction with this famous fish sauce that I think I taste in a lot of your dishes at the Fatties? And, you know, talk about that ingredient in particular, because it's so pungent and delicious, and it really makes a taste stick with you for hours after. And, you know, just let's talk about the Fatties for a few minutes and, sure. You know, how you challenge yourself, you know, after all these years while still staying true to, you know, the vision of the restaurant.
Yeah, well, I mean, fish sauce is... it's extremely necessary. I mean, there's every time I feel like something's missing something, I add fish sauce in it, and it seems to be perfect. Yeah.
Voila.
Well, it's has the umami, it has salinity, it just brings so much to a dish. And
overpowering it, right? It kind
of obviously. I mean, there's certain fish sauces that are extremely potent. Your generic average fish sauce, we use Three Crab at the restaurants, and it's a good brand. It's actually a guy that used to make, came from Vietnam, came to San Francisco, and actually started making fish sauce in San Francisco. And it was under such high demand that he actually moved back to Vietnam to make the fish sauce, to re-import it back.
Wow.
Because it was just, probably cheaper and easier, and you obviously can make more in Vietnam than you can in San Francisco.
Cheaper
rent for sure, cheaper fish. But the fish sauce itself is very good, but the idea behind fatty and what fatty is the use of seasoning that's in the style of Southeast Asia. So that means
Malaysia, right?
Yeah, Malaysia, Singapore, Indonesia, Thailand, that whole Vietnam. I mean, that whole area of the world has a touch to the food that the real backbone of it is salt and heat and acidity and bitterness and really edgy, bright and sharp flavors, and applying that flavor profile to what we have here locally in New York is really the heart of what we try to do. And at the same time, I throw in things that are special to me. We make an Asam Laksa. It tastes like Asam Laksa that you get in Malaysia, because Zach and I went to Malaysia again together and ate Asam Laksa and talked about it. And when we came back to the States, it was important to us that the Malay people, or really anybody who came into our restaurant, truthfully, people that eat Asam Laksa are Malay, but or Singaporean, but they they come into the restaurant and they literally walk up to the window after eating and thank us.
Yeah.
Because it's they're not the kind of thing that you can get. And at the same time, we'll take we'll take goat. Like right now we're doing goat lob at Fatty Q in Brooklyn. Mm-hmm. We're doing goat curry with some house made kimchi and rice, and that's not Malay. Mm-hmm. it's a combination of these flavors and these styles, and a product that's local and special to us. Mm-hmm. and just combining them and mashing them up and putting it out there.
You're making me so hungry.
Yeah.
Now, is that your goal as a chef, to just make people happy? I mean, it was interesting what you said at the beginning, one of those flash memories of just having a big space and realizing that it was a whole event, when you would go out and eat. Yeah. I mean, is that what you're into, is just seeing smiling faces and having someone come up and say that was blew my mind, or is it more personal?
I think, it's kind of changed what I've been into, I guess. When I'm in one store, I really do love that personal touch, and that's really what Fatty Downtown is all about. The kitchen being in the dining room and that personal touch.
You were there for a lot of years.
Yeah, it's been 6 years now. Mm.
You've not been.
Huh?
That you have? I mean, you were in.
It's been 6 years total. Yeah. I mean, that's from day one to day now.
Do you spend less time in the kitchen now?
I mean, it's hard for me to spend time in the kitchen downtown because it's so small. Mm-hmm. But there's. I spend time in all of the kitchens, and I spend time with all of my chefs, and I do a lot of bouncing around now. But I mean, for instance, this weekend, Thursday, Friday, Saturday, I pulled shifts uptown. Expedited uptown. Great.
How
specials.
Have they reacted to your food on the Upper West Side? I mean, was it an uphill battle? Because downtown, it makes total sense. But I was looking at actually the 60 restaurants that Heritage Food sells to in New York, and I think something like 54 of them are below 14th Street. So it's interesting. How has it been up there?
Actually, it's great. The Upper West Side, needs to embrace you as a neighborhood restaurant, so you have to be a neighborhood restaurant.
Right.
And I feel like we are that. I can say wholeheartedly that we have the best cocktail on the Upper West Side. It's for darn sure. So,
which is?
All of them.
All of them.
What's that? The bone? The fatty bone?
Well, there's the smoke and bone. Is something that we do from Q, and there's the bone shot. They're all just variations on the bone, which is just whiskey, Tabasco, lime juice, and sugar. That's just great. But, I mean, just in general, the bartenders up there and the caliber of the program up there is just, I mean, it just has high standards. So the cocktails that come out of there are excellent. Mm-hmm. And I think that, a lot of people on the Upper West Side are not used to that. They're used to getting, you know, sweet and, right. you know, watered down, mm-hmm. you know, not high quality booze cocktails. And yeah. that's not what we do. And, you know, it's the same thing with the food. We create an atmosphere that's fun, also has a level of seriousness to it. You know, the food is spicy, but I think we take an approach uptown that's more in the style of, you know, more noodle dishes, Indonesian nasi goreng, and you know, things that are slightly more approachable, things you can wrap your head around. Mm-hmm. But we definitely don't dumb it down for the Upper West Side.
No,
you know, there's a young demographic up there. There's Columbia up there. All these Columbia students come through and have drinks and eat pork buns. It's fantastic.
It's remarkable how. Well, this is interesting for our next guest who's going to come in after the segment. You know, the haves and the have-nots. Those are people that have, for the most part, on the Upper West Side, and yet they do not have good restaurants. Up until very recently, it had always been a kind of food desert, which is crazy to say that.
Right.
But of all the great restaurants, there was different literally none on the Upper West Side. And then Chesca opened, and there was that Tom Valenti, Fatty Crab. So it's kind of interesting how the haves and the have-nots, you would think where the money is would be where all the great restaurants are, but that's actually not the case. So, well, this has been really, really cool. It sounds like you're going to sit in. We're going to bring in Anthony Butler after the break. But, Corwin, this is, you got to come back because I got to about a quarter of the questions that I wanted to about do Americans eat too much meat? How do you do quality fish sourcing? Oh, my God, we didn't get into anything.
I know. It's okay. We didn't have enough time, Patrick.
We didn't have enough time. But we will take a break, and Jack will air our sponsorship, which is, I think, Sam Edwards today.
From S. Wallace Edwards & Sons in Surrey, Virginia. We support the Heritage Radio Network because we believe in the cause and what they're doing. They're supporting family-raised livestock, small family farms, certified humane, pasture-raised, antibiotic-free. Basically, we take the products from Heritage Foods USA and make them into Serrano-style hams, prosciutto-style hams, bacon, sausage, like my grandfather did. You can find us at Surrey Farms. .com or virginiatraditions.com.
Anthony Butler is the executive director of Bread and Life. Bread and Life daily addresses the issues of hunger and poverty in Brooklyn and Queens. Every day, Bread and Life serves over 1,000 meals to hungry New Yorkers. They provide these services both at their Lexington Avenue facility and through their unique mobile soup kitchen. For many, the meals that Bread and Life provide are the only meals they have. Their goal is to combat poverty and help people achieve self-sufficiency, in addition to educating the public and increasing awareness about meals to needy New Yorkers. Anthony, thanks so much for coming into the studio today.
It's great to be here.
Tell our listeners, I mean, I'd read that brief paragraph, but the true mission of St. John's Bread and Life, and tell us how it works.
The true mission is as you mentioned in the brief reading, to bring food to those who don't have enough food. That's actually an old piece of text. We're actually doing about 2,000 meals a day.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
And we also bring necessary services because we hunger in this community and in this country is an issue of economics. People don't have enough money to get their food. And so we also bring tax services to help people get their justifiable income taxes back. We have food stamp application on site, Medicaid application on site, medical services, legal services, helping people with immigration. Getting identification, because all of us know without proper identification, we can't get in half the buildings in this city. So working with that. And a big part of our around food is a lot of work around nutrition.
Well, tell us how you actually have found a way to encourage people to eat nutritiously.
We have what we developed when we built our new building here in Bed-Stuy is what's called a digital food pantry. And that was done for two reasons. First of all, I think people should be served the most dignified way possible, and technology is kind of the normal way we do things. And also, I wanted to give people a choice of their food, because people won't eat what they don't like. And so we created a digital food pantry where people order off a touch screen, and it's based on the food pyramid. So they touch grains, they see what grains we have in stock, vegetables and whatnot. And basically, we give them a set of points, and if you will, things are priced cheaper that are more nutritious. So your fresh produce sometimes is free. Your unprocessed, say, chicken and things like that are lower costs than processed food, than, like, say, SpaghettiOs or something like that. We kind of flip the whole foods thing upside down.
Very smart.
Yeah, it's very, very interesting. So how does it work? So someone walks into your place, you know, with their family or alone, and they do what?
We assess the size of their family, get some kind of believable proof of where they live, and they're given a card, sort of like a credit card or a debit card.
Do you see what the, how much they make? I mean, do you ask questions to ensure that they're wealthy?
No, not exactly. Our model is that people are basically trustworthy. I've never believed that the poor are any less trustworthy than the rich. So
that's maybe, a whole show.
I know it is.
Occupy Wall Street. Yeah, we're talking about it.
So we're seeing a lot of that. So when people come with a need, they have a need. We do verify the kind of how the family's constructed, how many kids, and so on and so forth, and that. We're only serving one household. We don't have two people come from the same household. They're given points, more points for a big family, less points for a small family, and then they order off our kiosk for what they need.
And then the other stuff, you'll have like an information table where
they say, I
need help.
What we find is the food's the first reason people come, and we use that to engage people around, because I don't want to keep giving people food. People shouldn't have to come to places like ours. So to get on food stamps, let me give you an example of food stamps in the city. Last year, the city left $750 million on the table of food stamps, federal money that could have come into the economy, that could have been spent at that little farm stand out in front of here.
Wow.
You know, that kind of money. That's three-quarters of $1 billion. That the USDA is just sitting on because applications haven't been done. And so we're working on that.
And so the shop itself, so you say the kiosk, so when they don't do the shopping themselves, they like punch in their order.
They punch and somebody in, goes picks it in the back. Part of the reason for that is really square footage. We couldn't do kind of a supermarket kind of setup. Now with that, as part of our work with that, we're doing a significant amount of work around sustainable food. We have, right now, twice a week, we have cooking classes around. We partner with two farmers upstate, one in Goshen and one in Hoosick Falls, bringing in fresh produce. We did about 60,000 pounds last year. And we cook with what's in season. Sort of get people to cook stuff so their kids will eat it kind of thing, around more nutritious food. And so what the idea is, say the fresh produce we have in stock, you can also go to a cooking class to see how to use it.
Great.
And then you get to take some home with a little recipe or something like that.
Now, so who delivers the food, though? How does the food get people, to you, and who cooks it?
These people cook it at home. These are all groceries, if you will. Okay. These are uncooked food that they take home to cook to their families. We also have on site, we have a soup kitchen that like a diner, like a restaurant. Out of that, we do probably more meals than are doing here at Roberta's. We do, on Friday, we did 1,100 meals out of that. Wow. I would describe it as decent diner food. That's sort of what we're producing out of there. With that, we also have a mobile soup kitchen, a 37-foot orange Winnebago. You can't miss it. It's basketball orange. And that goes to it really is. That goes to poor communities here in Williamsburg, in East New York, in Coney Island, Jackson Heights, Elmhurst, Woodside. Which also brings our mobile model. It brings services. We have a small office on the back to try to provide people with services and brings food.
So when you talked about 2,000 meals, is that prepared meals or that's the groceries?
That's all total. That's total. We're doing about 1,100 prepared meals and then about another 900 groceries.
Got it.
Now, tell us about this big October 24th event, because that's one of the few times where the general public could come and participate and help this cause.
We're having an event at our place at 795 Lexington Avenue in Bed-Stuy, Lexington Avenue between Patchen and Malcolm X. on October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30. And it's an invitation to all folks who are interested in food, the purveyors, the cooks, the eaters, if you will, to see what we do. I mean, I think a lot of people think soup kitchen, and they think kind of like 1930s, you know, white men in fedoras standing outside with an apple.
Right.
You know, it's the kind of image that we have. A very high tech, our building won an American Institute of Architecture Award, and it's also that these are our neighbors we're serving. Mm-hmm. And we want to participate. I heard in your lead-in talking about the have and have-nots. And some places purvey food to people who have means. And we purvey food to people who don't have means. And I think there's an inherent partnership between all of us in terms of how important food is, the sustainable pieces of food, the justice issues of food, the taste of food, the kind of relationary aspects of food. And we want to bring people together, and we want to bring the food community together so we can learn from them. Mm-hmm. Because one of the outcomes we hope to have, besides giving you good wine and good hors d'oeuvres and showing you around our place, is really to develop a sort of advisory board for me in terms of so we can partner better and really impact these food issues in the community.
Because, I mean, raising money is a challenge. How much money are you responsible to raise to keep this whole ship going?
I have to raise approximately $3 million a year.
Wow.
And of that, 90% or 89% of it, excuse me, is privately raised. There's very little government. People think of government funding. There's very little government funding in food. It's really a misnomer.
So how do you do it? That's a huge number.
I go on radio stations and ask people for money.
good. And have this big October 24th event. We're running PSAs all throughout. Fantastic. On the radio. You can go to our website to find out. Yeah. Give this website at the end.
Tony, I have a quick question. Yeah. Have you seen your client base change? I mean, there's a lot of talk about sort of the new rich, but there's also the new poor.
It is. It's changed and grown. We saw last year a 35% increase, and the preponderance of those folks were families. They were families who were formerly, you know, somebody was working as a dishwasher, somebody was working as a waiter, a bartender, those kind of occupations where they got laid off and don't have enough money to make ends meet. Though, but to give you an example, I was at a trade show around restaurant stuff, and I had a vendor tag on, so it means everybody comes at you, a buyer tag, so everybody thinks, you know, I'm going to purchase something.
Get the bullseye on your back.
Yeah, and somebody comes up, and I'm like, here we go, here's another sales pitch, and he goes, I want to thank you. And this is a trade show over at the Javits Center. I said, thank me for what? And he says, well, I was a client of yours for 3 months. Wow. And this is a software guy.
Wow.
It's a guy working. It was a software system for restaurant ordering. And he said, yeah, I got laid off. Unemployment ran out. And you folks got me through with the food pantry.
Fantastic.
Well, what can our listeners do to help?
They can help in several ways. They can volunteer. They can donate. They can write their congresspeople, because as food goes, we go. They can come to this October 24th event, and all the information can be found at www.breadandlife.org.
Bread and Life.
Bread and Life, all spelled out, no ampersand, breadandlife.org.
Very interesting. Now, how many people work under you at Bread and Life?
We have a staff of 25.
A staff of 25 people.
And then on any given day, we probably have 30 to 40 volunteers from the community, from seniors to elementary school groups doing projects, to people on community service, to people with significant developmental disabilities. And without them, we could not do the work.
And who's on your board?
Our board runs the gamut from community folks to wealthy folks to politically connected folks, because all this work, just like a good restaurant, I think you were mentioning about how up in the Upper West Side you have to be a neighborhood restaurant first before you can get in. Mm-hmm. Well, to be a good purveyor of services in a community, you have to be sort of a neighborhood restaurant too. And so our board reflects that, from folks who bring significant means to folks who bring significant access to folks who bring expertise. And the people we work with.
So in the spirit of Occupy Wall Street and all this, I mean, I would be interested to hear your take, and if you can give us insight on, you know, this food access, you know, and what is the problem? And I mean, have you found two or three bullet points that really communicate what the problem is in this country about people not having access to nutrition? Where are the bottlenecks? What's wrong?
There's some bottlenecks in terms of access just simply not being available in certain communities. Historically, fresh produce and things like that, historically, particularly sustainable stuff, has been more expensive. So they tend not to gravitate to the poor communities. And those the food needs are met, then again, by fast food restaurants. I think that would be the first one, the physical access. I think there's not been as strong a partnership between All the people in the food world, and that's one of the things we're trying to get going on the 24th, mm-hmm. between the farmers, between the emergency food folks, between kind of political food folks, the USDA. I think that's the other piece. And I think the third piece, in the spirit of Occupy Wall Street, that this is a justice issue. It's not a handout issue. A handout is something you do because we don't want people starving. But it's a justice issue because there's not fair access to food. Right now. And I think that's got that certain policies and certain economic policies have made our food industry very stilted towards large providers.
Is that a segment of your mission to change policy?
There's a big part of a significant part of my mission is to advocate for the folks in terms of how the policy either affects them positively or negatively. One of the things I've gotten more active in is the no farms, no food folks.
Mm-hmm. What a great tagline.
It isn't. And they're neat people because I started realizing that this is not simply an issue of getting more food stamps or getting more emergency food to folks, but it's an issue with the farmers. They have the significant issues. It's an issue of economics. And I read some statistic that it's really the only growing industry upstate is farming.
Wow. Very, very interesting. So, I mean, in our final minutes, I've got to know, because you're so well-spoken. You're such a nice guy. You're doing such important work. How did you come to lead such an organization? And I'm just thinking of our listeners who are like, I want to work in the nonprofit world. And what skill sets do you really need, or that you get pushed really to the brink to have?
The two big skill sets are a passion and the ability to run a business. They don't always go together, but I think they do. My brother-in-law runs a garden nursery out in Indianapolis. And we got talking, we got laughing. Here's a for-profit guy, and I'm running a nonprofit. It's the same kind of thing. It's a small business kind of mentality that's responding to the needs of the community. And that's what it is. And it's a passion fundamentally about the people you serve. Just as good food providers are passionate about, you know, the pig, you know, eat me and save me kind of thing. They're passionate about the folks they're serving to bring them good food. We have to be passionate about the dignity of the folks we're serving. And that's what brings good people to nonprofit world.
It's also what makes a lot of nonprofits struggle, because they're so mission-driven, but they don't know the sort of fundamental business
skills. And that's where you need a board.
Right.
That's where you need a board, that you have to have people that know those ins and outs. Mm-hmm. I mean, I accidentally come to it. I'm a social worker by trade. I'm better at this than, you know, reading spreadsheets kind of thing. And so you need to, and that's why it's got to be a partnership. That's why it's got to be a partnership of people coming together to respond to these needs.
Are you like a football coach that's always motivating the troops to work harder, faster, better?
Yeah, I think there is a piece of that. It depends who I'm talking to. If I use a sports metaphor, or I'm one of those evil chef, kind of guys on those talk shows.
Just insulting people, berating them.
I never found that really works at all. But it makes me feel better, but it's not really very effective.
Well, Todd has a good line he's always tried to instill in me. He's like, you can be critical of someone, but by the end, they have to get better. They can't hate you.
Right. You want them leaving focused on the problem, not on how mean you were.
Well, because it's not – one of the dangers of nonprofits is you can fall into that it's about me.
Right.
It's not about me. It's the folks I'm serving. So I have to do whatever I've got to do to get the highest possible level of service. That's the duty I have and the responsibility I have.
So give us one last October 24th, time and place.
October 24th, 795 Lexington Avenue, Brooklyn. It's between 6:30 and 8:30. It'll be a good time. Find out about food, what we do in emergency food, how you can help, and how we can work together.
There are going to be some big chefs there. I've already gotten commitments from a few people. Hopefully we'll have someone from the queues there. And no, it's a really tremendous event, and Heritage is going to put all its energy behind it, both the radio and with the big event. So thanks so much for coming.
Thank you.
We want to have you back on before the event as well, really blow it up and get as many people there as possible. Corwin, people can go and taste Corwin's everything he talked about, which I thought was fascinating. Great interview, one of the best chef interviews we've done. There's Upper West Side. There is two places in the Village, Fatty Q and Fatty Crab downtown, and there's also in Williamsburg Fatty Q Brooklyn. So
I don't want to leave out St. John, which just actually opened up on Friday. That's a big ups to St. John.
Yes, we have a lot of listeners in St. John.
I know. That's why I figured I'd say so.
Tell us about that. Give us the headline on that. That did open just now?
Yeah, well, it closed for hurricane season, and then it reopened on Friday. Yeah, I mean, St. John's great. It's our third Fatty Crab. It opened up this past season, and it's a funny place. I mean, it has the complete opposite of what we have here. The things that are local are papaya and mango and lemongrass and kefir, and the things that are imported are all the stuff from here.
Water.
Yeah, water. Yeah, exactly. Please come by.
Fatty Crew. Is that your website? The Fatty Crew?
Yeah, fattycrew.com.
Fattycrew.com with that awkward silhouette of
C-R-E-W. Zach and Rick and the Charlie's Angels look.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
No hot women, unfortunately, in that logo. But this has been a great show. Jack, great job editing and producing. And Katie Kiefer is going to premiere her show in about 10 minutes. So thanks for listening, everybody.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on heritageradionetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening. As a part of National Food Day, St. John's Bread and Life, Brooklyn's innovative and life-saving food service program based in Bedford-Stuyvesant, is inviting Brooklyn chefs and purveyors to learn about how the organization is marrying the procurement of old-fashioned, locally grown organic produce with the latest technology to deliver healthy, cost-effective meals to those in need. St. John's Bread and Life, located at 795 Lexington Avenue, will hold an open house on Monday, October 24th from 6:30 to 8:30 p.m. Visit www.foodday.org to sign up for the event. The following message has been brought to you by Taste Brooklyn. Our city's finest chefs partner with farmers and local vineyards next to the Green Market for an extraordinary outdoor culinary festival. Try exquisite delicacies using locally grown seasonal delights on the plaza outside Brooklyn's Borough Hall. Top chefs and artisans will offer sumptuous fare paired with premium wines, all to empower our neediest children to get healthy. The mighty FDNY and DSNY harbor their own culinary masters in uniform. They will cook off against the pros. Sample delicious cuisine without stressing over a reservation while supporting a worthy cause. Taste Brooklyn's Field to Fork Outdoor Culinary Festival, Saturday, October 15th, 2011, from 11:30 a.m. to 3 p.m. Learn more and buy tickets at tastesofbrooklyn.blogspot.com. That's TASTESOF Brooklyn.blogspot.com.